I was still out there, and I didn't know there was any young sober men around. He's getting like me now. We're not so young anymore, but he was an inspiration. It took me a little while after I met him to get in here, but I did, and it's been a good ride. So I'm going to let you listen to his story, and I believe you're going to be amazed before he's halfway through.
Aloha, my name is Nick and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
And I was going to impress you with some sort of Hawaiian saying, but my English ain't too good, so I'm not even going to try another language. It was so bad when I was in high school, they let me take English as a second language. So anyway. First, I want to thank the committee so much for letting me come and share in the 30th anniversary. I really want to thank Jerry, especially. He's a special human being and a really special person in my life. And I'm also fortunate enough to know two of the original founders of this roundup, Altoona Roundup, and I was real fortunate to have met and known Groves and also Joe Nelson. And those are some really good people, and we should definitely remember those guys and the fact that they started this, and we just keep going. So I really really excited to be here at the 30th anniversary, and excited to be here. And I apologize. I'm gonna get emotional, probably even cry at some point during this talk, and it's not for dramatic effect. It's not to sort of empathize. I get embarrassed by it, but I'm just a sensitive person. I mean, I'll cry at a dog food commercial, but it hits me just right. That's just the way I am. But like I was talking about, Jerry, who's the chairman of this committee, me and him go way back, And at one time, actually, he was my sponsor when I lived here in Atlanta. He told me something that I'll never forget. It was so funny. I went over to his house one day and, I don't know, whining about something. And he just looked at me and he said, "You're the only person I ever met in my life who works the promises backwards." I said, "What?" He said, "You're the only person I ever met in my life who works the promises backwards." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You intuitively baffle situations you used to handle." There's a lot of truth to that. And the other thing, one time me and him used to go out and speak a lot on the what we called the turkey circuit, where they feed you and you go and you go around and you share your story and that sort of stuff. And one night we had 20 minutes each to talk, and I had forgotten my watch. We just had 20 minutes. And so I asked Jerry, I said, "Let me borrow your watch," I said, "because I just got to make sure I don't speak over 20 minutes. And he looked at me and he goes, "You can't borrow my watch. My watch is 10 minutes fast." It's great to be back in Atlanta. I spent a lot of years in Atlanta. I've been in Hawaii for about the last 6.5. A lot has changed in Atlanta. A lot's changed, but a lot's still the same. I went to a good quality AA meeting last night, and they were talking about helping the still suffering alcoholic, and that was great. And it's hot as hell, and that hadn't really changed. And I was with Jared the other day, and it was probably about 105 degrees, and I was about to melt. While I was sitting with him, it occurred to me that the next speaking or engagement that I have for Alcoholics Anonymous is in Anchorage, Alaska, the first week in March. And I was thinking, man, this is like a microcosm of my alcoholism, one extreme to the next extreme. The hottest part of the summer and the coldest part of the winter. It's like some sort of natural extremes AA reality show or something like that. Watch Nick as he loses his serenity, sweating his ass off, about to go crazy. Look at Nick as he complains about being bitterly cold for a week and not seeing any light. You can take your AA program with you. Don't mean you're going to use it all the time, that's for sure. Well, like I said, I'm going to get into involved with my story, but just to give you guys a couple of examples. I moved to Maui about 6.5 years ago, and it's a all the stuff that you hear about, oh, how nice it is and how beautiful it is and what a great place it would be to live and the weather's always good and there's so much to do and all the good times and all this, it's a paradise. Well, it's true. It's true. But when I first, you know, and it's really, what I really too like about it, it's really culturally diverse and integrated and really culturally diverse because they brought a lot of people in to work the sugarcane plantations. And so, I mean, it's just so integrated. There's a lot of Japanese, Chinese, Portuguese, Filipinos, people from all over. And it's really like a mosaic where everybody sort of mixes and there's, I mean, our potlucks, dinners are just amazing, and you work with all these different people, and it's really neat. But they have all these sort of, the language is a little different. There's all these like slang sayings that I had never heard from coming from the South. And when I first moved over there, I was working as a nurse, and I kept getting shishi and shoyu mixed up. Shishi means I need to go to the bathroom, and shoyu means soy sauce. And so every time I'd be working as a nurse and somebody would say they got a shishi, here I come with the soy sauce. They're like, what in the hell is wrong with this guy? They're like, keep that nurse away from me, you know. But funniest thing was, is I was working as a, I was actually, you know, I worked my way into administration, and one day we were having like a potluck thing, and the nursing supervisor came in, and we were just eating and eating and eating, and he came in, and he was kind of excited, and he goes, chicken nut bread, chicken nut bread. And I thought, it must be some good stuff. I mean, I can't imagine putting chickens and nuts on bread, but whatever, chicken nut bread. And then, so I just kept eating, and then he came back in, and he was really excited, like jumping up around, saying, chicken nut bread, chicken nut bread, chicken nut bread. I said, damn, this must be some really good stuff. And then I was like really getting nervous because he came back in and he started slamming on the table, chicken nut bread, chicken nut bread. So I turned to the lady, I said, what is he saying? She says, she cannot breathe, she cannot breathe. Anyway, so it took me a little getting used to the place, but it's really amazing. Just to get it out of the way, I got sober March 31st, 1989. So I have a little over 18 years of sobriety, one day at a time. And I got sober when I was just turned 17. I had been sober maybe 20 days. I was born March 9th, 1972. So I got sober when I was 17, came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll tell you more about it, but I'll tell you it's the best thing that ever happened in my life, plain and simple. I stumbled upon something absolutely so amazing that I just can't tell you. I didn't necessarily think of that when I first came in, but you know, it's just important for people to know that they can come in young, and you don't have to go back out there. And that you know, if you stick around, amazing things will happen in your life. Well, I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, like I said, in 1972. And the first sort of big significant thing that happened in my life was that my parents were divorced when I was 5 years old. And for a lot of years, I liked to pretend like that didn't really affect me in any way or whatever. But I drank a lot of alcohol over that when I got a little older. And so I ended up living with my mom, and my brother ended up living with my dad for a while. Then we got back together. And then another big significant thing happened was is when my mom was kind of like, you know, she was just out there doing her thing, going around, and we were really pretty poor. And my mom finally decided that, you know what, I'm going to do something with my life. And so she got into this government program to go back to college, and they put us in this white trash project in Verona, Mississippi, and right outside of Tupelo. And that's where we lived. And when I was there, you know, I saw a lot of things, you know, a lot of stuff that you see in like so lower socioeconomic sort of environment like that. A lot of violence, a lot of drugs, a lot of alcohol, just the stuff that comes with the projects, you know. And I didn't realize how much that affected me for a while, but, you know, it did. But, you know, and I experimented a little bit when I was living there, but not anything necessarily significant. But what did happen was my mother, she did exactly what she said she was going to do. She went through school, we got through all that, and she ended up doing good for herself. And she became a nurse And so we moved down to Mobile, Alabama. And we lived there for a while, and that's really where my drinking started there, was in Mobile. And just to give you some sort of, for what it's worth, historical background, both my grandfathers died from the disease of alcoholism young. I mean, one of them died at 62 with liver complications, and the other one died when he was 63, but he had an alcohol-induced stroke when he was 49, and he spent the last 13 years of his life paralyzed. And then I have we have a pretty small family, but I have myself, my brother, and three first cousins in that generation, five of us. And I'm an alcoholic. My brother, who's here tonight, amazing human being, he has 10 years sober. We have another cousin who's in and out of the program, one who's just a big drunk, and one who overdosed and died. And we just don't drink well. I mean, we just don't drink particularly well. And I give you, you know, it said right there in the big book about, I mean, when Bill was talking about not heeding the ominous warning, that's what happened to me the first time. And that's significant. And I'll tell you about the first time I ever got to drink, like, unabated, much as I could drink. I was a freshman in high school. I had been experimenting, but I was a freshman in high school, and my brother was a senior. And his buddies had inadvertently, by accident, invited me to this, like, senior keg party. And Kelly's like, "You didn't invite him, did you?" They say, "Well, we didn't think anything of it." And he's like, "No." So anyway, I went to the keg party, and I got there around 8. And started drinking out of the keg. And I remember after having about 3 or 4 beers, this phenomenon came over me. And it was like, this is it. I don't even know what it is, but this is it. This is what I've been missing my whole life. Because before I ever took a drink, honest to God, as I'm standing here, I always felt apart from and not a part of, uncomfortable in my skin, just like I could just never truly fit in. But when I had that drink and it got in my system, I mean, I felt like, this is it, man, this is it, from the first time. And I was like, I will do whatever it takes from here. I mean, I can remember like saying that to myself almost, well, I'll do whatever it takes from the rest of my life to get this, because this makes me feel what I've been missing. That was about 8:30. about 9:30, I was really getting sick. And I had blacked out by about 9:45. And by about 10 or 10:15, they had done the old knock on the door, open the door, and push me in, and I went bloop. And I kept coming in and out of a blackout. I got sick. I was on the verge of alcohol poisoning. I mean, I was sick. My mom was ready to go. My grandmother was there, and they were all freaking out. And I just remember bits and pieces of it. My dad talked to me on the phone. I got in so much trouble. And I got my brother in a whole lot of trouble. But the amazing thing was, I woke up the next morning, and my thought was, man, that was great. That was fantastic, man. That was like the best ever. Like, I was so excited. My brother wasn't nearly as excited as I was, but I mean, I was like elated, like just elated. So after that, I went after it hard, man. I went after it hard. I had found what was, you know, missing in me. And then, that was when I was 14, and by the time I was 17, but in the course of 3 years, my alcoholism went from, I never had years of functional alcoholism. I might have had months. And, you know, everybody's different in that respect, but that's just my story, and it's the reality. And just to give you an example, like in the 10th, I was drinking and doing drugs regularly, like every weekend, and then it started creeping into everyday sort of thing. But in my 10th grade year of high school, I was playing basketball on the basketball team, and I always loved sports. I always loved sports, but the only sport that I ever excelled at, just because I'm not necessarily gifted naturally or whatever, was basketball. I was a good basketball player. So I played on the basketball team, and I had a little job, and I was doing okay in school. I mean, you know, I wasn't doing great, but I was doing that, so, I mean, I had a fairly normal existence. But by my 11th grade year, I had quit going to high school. I had quit that job. I had, you know, they wouldn't let me play basketball because I wasn't going to school. And, you know, and and all that, you know, and I quit going to, and I didn't necessarily mind going to school. I wasn't big on the studying part, but I really liked to talk to everybody and sort of socialize and all that. I mean, I really didn't mind going to school, but I'll tell you what happens to me, and I think it happens to all of us, not necessarily like this, but this is what happened was, I really liked school. I really like to drink. I really like school. I really like to drink. School's getting in the way of drinking. Something's got to give. There goes school. Yeah, I don't mind my job. My job ain't so bad, but that job's getting in the way of my drinking. You know, but I don't mind my job, but it's getting in the way of my drinking. Something's got to give. Psh, job's out the door. I got some decent friends, but they always own me about my drinking. And, you know, they're decent enough friends, but something's got to give. Psh. And one about, you know, basketball, that was the hardest thing to give up. That really was the hardest thing to give up, but... You know, they wanted me to practice every day after school. You know, and at some nights we had to go play games. And I liked it, but something's got to give. Something's got to give when you got to go after it like I got to go after it. And what happened is by one, everything was eliminated, and all I left was with my disease of alcoholism. And that was it. It had taken everything from me. And from starting as a freshman to my 11th grade year, I had ended up living in this, which is ironic, but I mean, I had ended up living back in this white trash ghetto. Not the same one, but essentially the same place. It had taken me back from where I was getting the hell out of. It had taken me right back to it. And I was living in this white trash ghetto, and I was trying to hustle, you know, drugs and alcohol. Very unsuccessfully. I was living with my prostitute / stripper girlfriend and couldn't figure out why I was so insecure. We had like a little, we started out with this like one bedroom apartment. We started with an egg crate and we worked our way up to a twin bed. And I think that's about, where we stopped. But, And Chuck C. says something which I think is right on. I mean, I think it's actually profound. He said, the only thing worse for an alcoholic than bad fortune is good fortune. The only thing worse for an alcoholic than bad fortune is good fortune. Because here I was, 17 years old, not going to school. I had a girlfriend who was making a lot of money. And I had accessible to a lot of alcohol. And it don't take long to go down with that formula. It just don't take a whole lot of time down to go with that formula. Because she was a nice enough girl. I mean, you know, she was 19 and a half. Father was in prison. Mother was dead. She had had a rough. And she was trying to find some good in her life. And her good in her life was taking care of me. You know, trying to take care of me and trying to do, you know. So all that to say is that every morning, you know, my bottom started happening with stuff like happening like this. I don't know if this happened to you, but I'd go to bed at night and wake up the next morning feeling guilty. Whether I had done something the night before, whether to feel guilty about, but I'd wake up and I would just feel guilty. And I would feel less than, and I would feel shame. And I'd have this physical knot in my stomach. And then the only thing that would take that away was if I could get two Budweisers down and a joint. And I was like, you know. But then once I get that going again, I'm off and running. And today's not going to be the day that I'm totally wasted by 3 o'clock was out of the window. And it was the same thing over and over and over and over again. And, you know, I'm embarrassed to say this to this day, but the reality was my bottom happened was, because I walked out of the bedroom one day and she goes, I hate to tell you this, but you hadn't changed your underwear in 8 days. And she was keeping count. And and my underwear, I literally were probably about as black as this thing right here. They were black, really were. And I turned to her with all sincerity that I had in my body. And I said, I don't care. And I meant it. I did not care. I was cut off spiritually, you know. I was cut off, like totally at that bottom, you know, I was spiritually bankrupt. I didn't care about you, and I didn't care about me. You know, I just didn't care anymore. I was hopeless. And about a month before I ended up in treatment, I looked in the mirror. I was literally avoiding mirrors, man. But I looked in the mirror one day, and I was tired of fighting it. I was tired of fighting it. So about a month, I just said, you know what? This is the way I'm going to be the rest of my life. To hell with it. And then I really went after it hard after that. But I felt a whole lot of relief, man, by just quitting the fight. But I had a couple things happen. I had some friends come over to my house one day, some high school friends that were worried about me. And these guys were not top of the line choice kind of Phi Beta members or nothing like that. But they were worried about me. And they came and knocked on the door. And I kind of stumbled through there and I opened up. And they went like this. Because I weighed like 135 pounds then, big black. I was going down. And he goes, damn, you're the youngest dirty old man I ever seen. And, you know, I laughed at that, but that hurt so bad. That hurt so bad. And that was one of the things that made me start thinking. And the other was, as crazy as it sounds, it's true. All of my friends who were alcoholics and drug addicts and thieves, they had all somehow, and this is Mobile, Alabama education system I'm talking about here, but they had all managed to graduate high school. And some way or form or whatever. But I couldn't even get, I mean, they were kicking people out the door, but I just couldn't even get there to get kicked out, you know, to get through the system. And I felt so much shame about that, you know. I was like, let me just graduate high school, then I'll go ruin my life. And then, so somebody had told me one night at a party or whatever, if you go to treatment, they'll just give you all your high school credits. You ain't got to do nothing. You just go to treatment. Just go to treatment, they'll give you your high school credits. And I was like, damn, you got to... So what happened was one night my girlfriend was out partying or working or doing whatever she was doing, and I was anxious. And well, I was wanting her attention, you know. And then I hadn't been getting, you know, so I just decided, and plus I had this thing in the back of my mind about the high school thing. So I just decided I'm going to play this con right here. So I just got on the phone with her and I started crying. And I was like, oh, I'm an alcoholic. You got to help me. And so she came home and she's like, I can't deal with this. I'm taking you to treatment. So she called my mom, and I wasn't seeing a lot of my mom, wasn't getting along, you know, so good on that situation. So then next thing, my mom is there, and I'm like, man, this is working great. I got her attention, and I was like all jacked up on speed and been drinking, and I was like, and then next thing I know, I go to this treatment center, and they got nurses talking to me and doctors, and it's like, man, look at all this attention I'm getting. This is like, boom, I'm killing it, man, with this con. And then, like, about 2-3 days later, I was ready. Okay, enough attention. Appreciate all the attention. Ready to go. I go to try to get out of the place. Doors are locked. And they're like, nah, you're not going anywhere. And it was like, and this is the amazing thing, right? About the amazing alcoholic mind, in my respect. The millisecond that I had realized I had screwed that con up, like, okay, this wasn't working. I was like, okay, what I got to say, who I got to see, what I got to do to get the hell out of this place. I'll say what else, like, oh, AA, yes, oh, everything, meetings, everything. Okay, just like that, like, boom, you know, like, okay, I got to figure my way out of this mess. So, I got sober on the right day of the week. I mean, I just was fortunate in that respect. I was 17, and they took us up. I went to my first AA meeting. And I went to my first AA meeting, and it was a young people's meeting. Just happened to be that day of the week. And I thought long and hard about this, because for years I used to say, well, I don't remember a word that was said in that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Then I started saying, is that true? Is that true? Is that really true? Then I went like and really thought my memory, and I honest to God do not remember one word that was said in that Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It was like Charlie Brown's teacher, like, wah, 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 wah. That's what I remember. But I tell you what I do remember. I do remember this so profoundly from my first hour, and I was out of my mind, was some guy came up to me and he was smiling. He was smiling. I remember that smile today. I can see it so vividly because it had been so long since I had been around people that smile, period. And then he said something so profound and amazing. He said, I'm glad you're here. I was like, holy shit, man. It had been so long since I had heard anybody tell me they were glad I was there, you know? And then he said something even more profound. He said, won't you keep coming back? I was like, man, that He said that to me. I'm used to hearing, here he comes, hide your shit. I mean, and they were saying, he was like happy to see me, genuinely happy. Shook my hand, introduced me to other people and said, keep coming back. And I got back on that treatment bus that night. I said, I don't know what the hell that thing is, but I'm going back over there. Those people are nice, man. Those people care about me. Just like that. That's what I have to remember about working with the newcomer and just being there, you know. No matter what kind of day I had, how busy, this, that, or that, or that, I have to make myself available. Just simply put my hand out, tell somebody I'm happy to see them, keep coming back, and smile at them. That's what brought me back to my second and third and fourth meeting until I could figure out their worst steps and their worst sponsors. It was the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that kept me coming long enough to figure out about what the steps were. And I'm clear about that. And that's our responsibility. That's our responsibility to make it a welcoming and caring place for other people so that they can come back long enough to find the answer. And that's what happened. And that's why I have a passionate love affair with Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I was not worthy of that. I was not worthy of that. But they gave it to me, man. They gave it to me. And it changed my life. It changed my life right there on the spot, man. Because somebody cared about it. And so we have to keep that going. We cannot forget about the newcomers. We have to take the time and energy for them. And so I kept coming back. And, you know, I kept coming back, and I was in love with those people. But I was in love with drinking. And so for about the first 3 months, I was like drinking and going to meetings and drinking and going to meetings. Because I was trying to figure out how you could do both. I mean, I really was. Because I really, really, really liked those people. And, but, you know, I realized that the gig was up after a while. You know, I just kept coming back. And you know that saying about, I want what they got? And I did. I didn't know what it was, but there was something about these people I had never felt a part of until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Never. But when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt like I was part of something, man. I was part of it. So I kept coming back and just kept coming to meetings and meeting and talking with people and you know, and staying sober and getting a little bit more sane, you know. But, I mean, I was insane. I mean, I want to make that point that I was absolutely insane because I can remember when I was just first getting sober and they were like, you know, I used to think, I said this to somebody, a couple of people. I was like, you know, somebody might be bigger or stronger than me, but they're not better than me. And other people, nobody's smarter than me. I mean, literally, a monkey could have ran his life better than I was running my life. But I was convinced that I was in control. That's clinically mentally ill. That's delusional. That's crazy. That's what the hell, that's what I was. For about the first 6-8 months I was a lost soul. But I just kept coming back. Then I found something amazing, you know. I found the steps. And I found a sponsor and put the two of them together and things started happening in my life. I mean, started happening in my life. And I worked the first, second, third step, got on that, and I started laying on the fourth step. Oh, that's big, and that's, you know, and the boogeyman and all that sort of stuff, and I'm scared. And, you know, and a guy just told me, he said, well, you can't do a fearless and moral inventory if you're full of fear. Go back to the third step and work on that again. So I started working on the fourth step. And if you want the truth of the matter, that's when things started happening in my life. When I started working the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm a nurse by trade, and you know I learned in nursing school that there's all these sort of diagnostic tests, like if you have diabetes, they'll give you a glucose test, or if you have a broken bone, they'll do an X-ray or whatever. That fourth step was what it was for me. It was like a diagnostic tool of my alcoholism, right there in front of me in black and white. This is who I am. This is why I act the way I act. These are the fears I have. These are the things. I mean, it was really, I saw who I was and what my motivations were and how full of fear I was, am, were, whatever, fear-based, you know. Like, I had no clue about that stuff. I had no clue. I was excited to learn about it because once I learned about it, hell, there was something I could do about it. I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous, working the fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous, and ultimately the fifth, and working my way through the ninth step and making those amends. Absolutely changed my life. I had that experience sufficient to recover from working those steps. I was able to not be the same guy, but to be a different guy because I was able to look at it and do something about it. And equally or more, well, probably well, more important, the greatest single gift I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got a hell of a lot of gifts, is a relationship with a higher power. The single greatest gift I ever got. Because when I was out there, it was me against the world. It was me against the world. And I say this all the time, but I would not dare want to take on the world by myself today. When I get up in the morning, I say the third and seventh step prayer, do pages 85, 86, 87, and 88 in the big book, and I'm conscious that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and that I have a relationship with a higher power who will help me. And I don't have to take on the world by myself. I got that through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsors and all that sort of stuff. Fundamentally changed my life. Fundamentally changed who I am as a person, relationship with that higher power. And I got that in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I started working all the steps and things started happening in my life. One big thing that happened when I was about 3 years sober was I had my sponsor call me over to his house over in Woodstock. And he was living in a trailer, and rented trailer in one of these run-down trailer parks. And he said, "You're about 3 years sober. I want to know what you want to do with your life." I said, "Well, where is all this coming from?" He goes, "I want to know what you want to do with your life." Because I was about 20 then. I had a little dead-end job. It was a good job. It was a dead-end job. Wasn't going to school. Wasn't doing nothing. Just going hanging out. He said, "One of the most important things that I have ever heard in my life in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "Smart man learns from his own mistakes, but a wise man learns from the mistakes of others." Smart man learns from his own mistakes, but a wise man learns from the mistakes of others. So we're sitting in there. He goes, "I'm 37 years old. I don't really got no profession that I can hang my hat on. I have every month I struggle to pay my child support." He goes, because I was real grandiose. I told him, "Well, my ship's going to come in." I mean, that's what I told him. "I don't know how or what my ship's going to come in." And he goes, "That's exactly what I thought. That's exactly what I thought." And he goes, "You got to take care of the middle." And I said, "Well, I got all these dreams. He goes, "You know what? Come back tomorrow. Write down your dreams. We'll talk about them." So I came back tomorrow and I wrote three dreams down because I was a huge sports fan. I said, I want to be a professional baseball umpire. I want to be a caddy on the PGA Tour. And I forget what the third one was. Because I knew I didn't have enough athletic ability to be in professional sports, but I was going to try to find an end, you know. And those were really my dreams. That's what I wanted to do. And he goes, "You know what?" He goes, "You can chase any dream you want as long as you'll take care of the middle." And the middle can be for whoever, but for me, he was trying to tell me to go back and get an education. Do something you can hang your hat on. Get an education. And so I did like any good sponsoree. I flatly ignored him for 8 months. But that man browbeat me. Browbeat me to go back to college. Or to start college. And that wasn't my mom or my dad. Not to say nothing bad about my mom or my dad. That was my sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because he cared about me. And that's the kind of love that we get in this, you know, get in here. And so what happened was, I mean, I had to start. I graduated with a 1.8 GPA from high school. And that was including my PE credits. And I made A in PE. In 2 years, I had two PE classes, in each semester. So I couldn't find no school that would take me. I learned the word deferred when I kept calling them and they said, "You're deferred." The first guy I called said, "What does deferred mean?" He goes, "You're not getting in." But I found this junior college that would take me. In my first year of junior college, I didn't get one college credit. Not one college credit. I took my junior and senior year of high school as my first year in college. But I went, And I learned what they did sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous. One foot in front of the other. And, you know, and just one foot in front of the other. And so all that to say is I started that, and I went to school. I went to nursing school. I actually went to nursing school the 1 year they had a nursing program here in Cartersville from Floyd or Georgia Highlands, whatever they call it now. And I finished up there in Rome the second year. So I got my nursing degree. It took me a while, 3 years, but I got it. One day at a time, going to a lot of meetings, hanging out with this cat over here, and just being involved with Alcoholics Anonymous. And during the course of that, another amazing thing happened to me was I went to a young people's convention in Hawaii. And I went back there with another guy who's here tonight. We went to Hawaii together. So we went to Honolulu, and it was nice enough, but it's a big city. I'm from a big city. I wasn't overly whatever. It's nice enough, but it wasn't whatever. I mean, the first night we were there, we saw some guy smash another guy's car with a hockey stick, and I didn't even know they played hockey in Hawaii. Whatever, right. Big city. I was like, well, so like the third or fourth day I was there, at this banquet, they set you regionally, which was odd, but we sat with these guys regionally. So we sat in the south section, and they set us next to these guys from New Orleans. And the guy says, hey, we're going to Maui tomorrow. If you want to go with us, we can go for like 2 or 3 days. I didn't know these guys mattered, but they were nice enough to invite us. Maui could have been Guam for all I knew. I had no clue. I just said, oh, yeah, what the hell, I'll go. So I went to Maui, and I had traveled a lot, which I'll tell you a little briefly about. I had traveled a lot, but I flew over Maui, got off plane, I was there, and I stood and I looked out, and I never had this phenomenon before or after. I was there, and I just thought, man, this is paradise. I want to live here. And the next morning, I got up early and I went snorkeling around this big volcanic thing they call Black Rock. And I was with, and this turtle came up, and it was just me and this turtle. And I went around this thing, and I come up, and as I come up on the beach, there's a 16th green of the Kanapali North Course, and the mountains right above it. So I swear I came out of there. I looked at those mountains, I looked at that golf course, and I looked at that beach, and I said, what in the hell am I waiting on? But you know, I was right in the middle of nursing school, and so I couldn't necessarily join and run away with the circus. But it was a dream of mine. It was a dream of mine to live in Maui, and I never forgot that dream. So I came back and got involved, and then something else just absolutely amazing happened. Right before I got ready to graduate college, this is a true story. I was getting ready to graduate from nursing school maybe 2 weeks before graduation. And I went to the hole in the wall, 16 o'clock, Smokey the Death meeting. I had a golf hat on because I don't remember I had played golf or whatever. And this guy came up to me out of the blue and he goes, hey, you like golf? I said, yeah. He said, I'm here. I'm a caddy on the PGA Tour, and we're in town this week for the Bell South Classic. I said, you got to be kidding me, man. I was like, you got to be kidding me. I was like, that's been a dream of mine to be a caddy on the PGA Tour. And he goes, yeah, okay, whatever. He gave me the tickets. And so we became friends, and every time he would kind of cross through the U.S., he would stay at my house. And about a year after that, I said, Bill, you know, I never really told you this, but a long time ago I told my sponsor this is my dream. Now I graduated college. I want to go fulfill this dream. And what's so funny is when he came into that meeting in Smyrna, there was about 100, at that time it was about 155 professional caddies on the PGA Tour, 1996 or 7 when it was. There was three of them in Alcoholics Anonymous, three of them. And he just happened to be in the meeting I was in. You know, I don't know, but whatever it was, it was. And so he said, it's going to be hard, you know, I don't know if you can do it. But he gave me a list, just like I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. He goes, go get a job at a country club, learn this, da-da-da-da-da. So I did it, and I did it for a year, just exactly what he did. And in the summer of 98, just because I was a good employee, because I learned work ethics in Alcoholics Anonymous, they gave me a leave of absence from my nursing job. So we went to Vancouver. That was the first tournament, and we showed up there. And within 10 minutes of getting there, a guy's caddy couldn't get across the border or something, I had a job right there, like just like that. And that was on Monday, and we did the practice round, and he hired me for the week. And then it came to that Thursday, and there I was on the big time, between the ropes, caddying on the PGA Tour, just like I had always dreamed about. And the guy, Ian Steele, who played on the tour in 98, he was there, you know, Thursday, he hits the ball right down the middle, bloop, of the fairway. And I'm like, I'm living my dream. And then the next thought was, Jesus Christ, I hope I can walk down this fairway without falling down. And I was so nervous. But I used Alcoholics Anonymous, literally right there on the fairway. All I kept thinking was 1 foot in front of the other. And literally for the first three holes, I looked at my feet and I put 1 foot in front of the other. And I didn't fall down. You know, I mean, talk about dreams coming true in your life and taking care of the middle. And I learned all of that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I caddied on the tour that summer, and I've caddied on the tour on and off since then. You know, I'll do a couple weeks here or there. The LPGA comes to Hawaii. They'll have three stops next year, so I'll go work for them when they come in town or do whatever. And so I still do it. And then, you know, someday when I semi-retire or retire, I might go do it full-time. Who knows? But it was a dream. I took care of the middle, and you know, it was amazing. And then so that was great. And then I started doing real good at my when I came back and went back to work, I did real good. I went back, got a bachelor's degree. And what's amazing about that bachelor's degree, when I graduated that program with a 4.0 GPA, you know, amazing. And I give all that credit to Alcoholics Anonymous and the sponsor and the steps about and being involved in. And you know, professionally things kept you know, going along. And and just recently, I had about a year ago, there was a big position in our corporation, and I didn't really have the qualifications for it per se, but I decided I'd go interview for it just so I could get some face time with the corporate CEO, you know. And so I went, and I didn't get the job, but he said he was so impressed with my interview that he saw that they needed a way to be able to mentor executive leaders within our organization. So he started this program, and now they're funding me to get my master's in business, and I'm a fourth of the way through my master's program. And, you know, just one day at a time, and I finally was able to move to Maui. But just a couple of things I wanted to mention in the interim happened with that was... you know, this fellowship is everywhere. One time I was traveling in China, and I couldn't find a meeting, and I kept calling these people, and I kept calling this, and I was desperate to find a meeting, so I asked this lady to look it up in the phone book, and she got all mixed in the translation. Like, there's no Alcoholics Anonymous in the phone book in China, but I was desperate to find a meeting. And so she got all mixed up with the translation, and she started looking up wholesale liquor stores, and... And I thought, well, I mean, if I'm a wholesale, if I'm going to go out, what the hell, you know, get a good price on it. But I finally got in touch with this lady, and she had just flown. She was a journalist in Beijing, and she had just flown back from Canada, just gotten back. She had been 21-hour flight or something. She was all jet lagged. She says, but you know what? You sound like you need a meeting. I'll come get you right now. And so she came, drove all across Beijing, which is no easy feat, picked me up, and we just two of us had an AA meeting, you know. Where are you going to find that at, man? I was in trouble, and she helped me. And I had that happen to me all over the place, because I can get out of sorts, you know. I can get out of sorts, and I need Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why I don't say it's sobriety first for me, and it might be semantics or whatever, but I tried sobriety first. And when I'm just sober and I'm not really actively involved in AA, I'm unhappy and I'm miserable. And I don't feel good, and I can feel it in my bones, and I'm not nice to other people, and I'm insecure, and I'm out of sorts. When I'm working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, honest to God, my life is a lot better. I feel good. I'm okay with me, so I'm okay with you. I'm generally a happy-go-lucky guy. So that's why for me it's Alcoholics Anonymous first. No matter where I'm at, I've got to keep trying to work that program and get the meetings, and the people have always been there for me. One time me and my brother went on this cruise to the Caribbean, and it was a partying and umbrellas and all this sort of stuff and partying. We were pretty young then, and it was me and him, two young heterosexual males from the South, and these two homosexual ladies from Wisconsin. They had never been to the South, and we had never been to the North, and we didn't have shit in common, nothing in common. And we had the best time. We had meetings together, we laughed together, we cried together, because everybody was out of sorts on this cruise, man. Everybody was. And we cried about it, we laughed, talked about it, because we had that common solution, man. No matter who you are, what you are, we had that common solution. And I found out in the middle of the sea in the Caribbean, man. I mean, it's anywhere and everywhere. That's why I have a passionate love affair with Alcoholics Anonymous. Because this will give you what you want, man. More than all the material, that sort of stuff. It'll give you the ability to look in the mirror and like the guy you're looking at or the lady you're looking at and feel comfortable on the inside. It can give you that. It can give you that. It will give you that. It works. Alcoholics Anonymous, absolutely, you know, it works. That's all I can tell you. You know, I had some amazing things happen to me. Just, I don't know, just out of my mind sort of stuff happened to me. I started through that caddy job. I started working in television, doing all this stuff, and I was able to go to Super Bowls and World Series and be on the field for college football championship game. I mean, just amazing stuff, you know, just... I just think about this kid in the white trash ghetto, and how in the world did I ever get from there to here? You know, how did I ever get from there to here? And it's simply by working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then when I moved to Maryland about 6.5 years ago, I went out and I found a job and decided I was going to make the move, and there were things, and I moved out there. But before I went out there, I went to an AA convention on Maryland to just check out the AA people on Maryland, because as much as I loved it, if we didn't jive, I wasn't going, because that's my lifeboat, man. You just, you know, if they work, but they're hell of a good, they've got some good AA in Hawaii. And we're out in the middle of the ocean, so we kind of circle the wagons, man. We are a tight, tight, tight group. And got real involved in service out there. You know, I always have been involved with service with young people and stuff. And one of the things I'm most proud of, ever, in and out of AA, you know, is that I was one of the founding members of the Georgia Conference of Young People and Alcoholics Anonymous. I was one of the founding members, about 6 or 8 of us. And to my knowledge, I think I'm the only one that's still sober. I mean, you know, you cannot rest on your laurels. But we helped start that, and then when I went back out to Maui, amazing things, started getting involved with service, and then been out there 6 years, and I was elected the alternate chair. Went to the HAT and lost the chair election, became the alternate chair. Now I'm the area. Went to the HAT again to be the delegate. Lost to the same guy in the HAT on the delegate. So now I'm the chair. And it all works out. I mean, it's all worked out. And that needed to work out for a particular reason, and it's all worked out. So, I'm really involved in service there and excited and learning more about it there. And professionally out there, it's been just amazing. I started in the hospital and worked my way up through administration. And Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, they say help other people. And it's not just other alcoholics. And I sit in on a lot of it. I mean, I do a lot of strategic planning for the healthcare system in our county and in our state. And when I'm sitting at the table with these people making decisions that are affecting people's lives for now and for the future, and I just like, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is at the table with those people, you know. All the stuff that I learned in AA is at, you know, the principles. And actually the service that I did in AA allowed me to be a better employee, because I got some pretty thick skin, you know. I really don't get ruffled behind a lot of that stuff that I learned in AA. And so it's just cool, you know. And then this last year I was asked to be on the board of the directors for the Mental Health Association in our county. I was just floored, you know. I mean, I was like, not long ago, I was receiving the mental health. Now I'm on the board of directors and won an award for them for outstanding service in the last year. I get asked to be on other boards. And you know, during all that, I still got a sponsor. I'm still involved with service. Because Jerry told me, and it's very important about service, he'd say, service ain't for everybody. Service ain't for everybody. It's just for those that want to stay sober. So much truth in that saying, man. Secret to service is getting it out of your self-absorbed self, you know, helping other people. And I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been able to not only do that in Alcoholics Anonymous, but in my community and get involved in my community. And so the great gift is that I'm a respected person in my community, respected person in my Alcoholics Anonymous circle, respected person in my household, respected in my family, and I can look the guy in the mirror and respect that guy I'm looking at. That's a long way to come from that white trash 17-year-old strung out kid. And as much vision as Bill Wilson had, I don't know, man. I don't know, but as much vision as he had, I don't know if he could see the vision that the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous could turn a boy into a man. That's exactly what it's done. That's exactly what it's done. It's turned a boy into a man. And I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm so grateful to be here. And if you guys are ever out in Maui, I want you to come out and look me up. And because I'll know you're there, because they think I know everybody from the South. They're like, we had somebody here from Bogaluga, Texas. Do you know him? So anyway. But all I can do is leave you. I'm going to just leave you with the central theme of my talk. The thing that I told you first and that I'm going to leave you with is the single most important fact in my life. It's that I'm Nick and I'm an alcoholic.